from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Nina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, a love letter to 80s teen movies. That's what Kevin Smokler's new book, Brat Pack America, is all about. Smokler visited the cities and main streets where legendary 80s films took place, including Ferris Bueller's Day Off, The Breakfast Club, The Lost Boys, and Heathers. And he interviewed cast members, writers, and directors of the era to better understand what makes these films endure. Join us as we look back on 80s teen movies and find out from you what 80s teen flick rocked your world. We get started after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, and today for Michael Krasny. San Francisco-based author Kevin Smokler has always loved 80s teen movies, but so have many others. A lot of books have already been written about them. But then Smokler got the idea of visiting the places where his favorite movies took place. Their physical existence is a metaphor of their enduring greatness. So 2 years and 45 films later, Smokler brings us his book, Brat Pack America, A Love Letter to 80s Teen Movies, including 16 Candles, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Back to the Future, and Say Anything. He describes it as a trapper keeper full of interesting facts about these films. His book also offers insights into what the films say about America and pop culture from that era and why they're as loved today as they were then. Welcome back to Forum, Kevin Smokler.
Oh, thanks, Mina. It's great to be back.
Well, thanks for being here. I want to start our conversation, actually, by playing the opening to the film The Breakfast Club by John Hughes. This is the story, of course, of five very different kids who are forced together for a Saturday detention and leave having a very shared experience. This is The Breakfast Club opening.
Saturday, March 24th, 1984. Shermer High School, Shermer, Illinois. 60062. Dear Mr. Vernon, we accept the fact that we had to sacrifice a whole Saturday in detention for whatever it was we did wrong. And what we did was wrong. But we think you're crazy to make us write an essay telling you who we think we are. What do you care? When you see us as you want to see us. In the simplest terms, the most convenient definitions. You see us as a brain, an athlete, a basket case, a princess, and a criminal. Correct? That's the way we saw each other at 7 o'clock this morning. We were brainwashed.
I wanted to start with that opening to Breakfast Club because I feel like it's so emblematic of so many John Hughes, you know, teen films where, you know, the main character are teenagers, right? Mm-hmm. And it's told from their point of view. And where you write in the book that their struggles, which might feel basic to an adult, are like life or death to a teen.
That opening never gets old, does it? Like in 45 seconds, you know exactly what the movie is about. And it's a voiceover narration. And the thing I remember fascinated about at the time is it sort of time stamps itself. It says the day it happens. It says the time of day it happens, the day of the week it happens. It says where it happens, which...
And that's exactly why I also wanted to play this, because it very clearly states, you know, Shermer High School, Shermer, Illinois. But what's amazing is that there is no Shermer, Illinois. No. It's not a real place. So as someone who is trying to go to the real places where this movie took place, how did you do Shermer, Illinois?
So it's funny. The most recent biography I found of John Hughes actually has an entire sidebar on like page 14 devoted to, is Shermer real or not? And The Breakfast Club in those opening moments is the only place that Shermer has ever spoken aloud. And yet the idea of Shermer is so resonant that people have looked for it. No, it does not exist. And John Hughes biographers felt the need to be very clear. Don't go looking for it. You won't find it. Shermer is actually Northbrook, Illinois, a north suburb of Chicago where John Hughes grew up as a teenager himself and later raised his own family. And the entire north suburbs of Chicago was his inspiration and his muse. And it's why so many of his movies, including all four of the teen movies that he wrote and directed, took place there.
And is it, as it appears in the films, a suburb, you know, tree-lined, upper middle class? Sort of white and
I think it was in the 1980s. It certainly isn't anymore. The north suburb, in fact, a map I found from the Yale School of Architecture says the north suburbs of Chicago are now more diverse and integrated than the city of Chicago. So those two things have flipped in the last 30 years. And if we did The Breakfast Club today, The Breakfast Club was filmed in Des Plaines, which is to the south and west of Northbrook, there would be one white kid, one Latino kid, one Asian kid, and one gay kid to be an accurate picture of what Shermer, I'm doing big air quotes here, would look like in 2016-17.
And what you marvel at in your book, though, is that with what now is such a narrow location, right, a narrow set of very specific attributes of a particular place that I think are harder and harder to find even today, right? That Hughes was able to create something really broad, something really influential.
Yeah, the thing I found magical about the John Hughes movies, both then and now, is that they were fables about being a teenager. They weren't documentaries or investigative reports about being a teenager. So they were both relatable and mythic in a way. I think most of us have felt the way his characters feel. Most of us have not hijacked a German Day parade the way Ferris Bueller did or served all-day detention. So the scenarios were a bit fantastical. They were something that we probably wouldn't find ourselves in as young people, but they were emotionally incredibly relatable. And in terms of them being in Chicago, you know, I grew up in the middle of the country. I'm 43 and I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, at a time when in pop culture, which I loved as much then as I do now, was mostly a coastal thing. Like even my beloved University of Michigan football team, if they had a championship season, played the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, not in Michigan. And so the idea that the story of my youth and my generation and people like me was coming from 4 hours down the road from the middle of the country, that was sort of the place where this idea of looking for a Brat Pack America began.
But you do bring up how it's relatable yet mythical. And one of the things that makes it so is that Hughes deals with really big themes, right? It's about true love and acceptance and self-love as well. I want to play the opening to 16 Candles. And actually, I should note that a listener, Sydney, writes that 16 Candles is her all-time favorite 80s movie. She says we all wanted to be Samantha in the end.
She has good taste.
And in this opening, Molly Ringwald's character, Samantha Baker, is looking at herself in the mirror. She's posing and she's talking to herself.
Chronologically, you're 16 today. Physically, you're still 15. Hopeless. Nope. I look exactly the same as I have since summer. Utterly forgettable.
You quote Molly Ringwald in your book where she describes Hughes as taking the pain of growing up and relating it to everyone.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I grew up the oldest child of three brothers, and all of my cousins were boys too. Like, I was not a teenage girl when 16 Candles came along. And yet, not only did I relate to Molly Ringwald and her struggle to sort of be seen and heard, but I related to her odd friendship, her odd off-center friendship with Anthony Michael Hall, and her sort of weird, uncomfortable relationship with her parents and her and her siblings, and not to mention that 16 Candles has perhaps the best father-daughter scene in contemporary movie history, when Molly Ringwald is, you know, been exiled to the couch and has this fantastic conversation with her father about, and her father says, if a boy can't recognize you for who you are, and this is a half decade before Riot Girl, like these movies were shockingly ahead of their time in many ways.
I remember loving 16 Candles when I saw it in the 90s. The 90s were my high school years, so I watched these films on VHS, which I should mention is what the jacket of your book is based on. It's a depiction of a VHS jacket. It's really great. And It's interesting. Now when I watch it, I feel like I can't watch it because there's moments that are now so uncomfortable for me in terms of the character, for example, of Long Duk Dong, right? This is a character who plays a foreign exchange student from Asia. He has a really thick accent. He has this naive fascination with all things American. And then there's also a moment when Jake Ryan talks about how his girlfriend is passed out drunk and he could violate her like multiple ways. Yeah. And so those things, you know, went right over my head in the 90s. But, you know, now as an adult watching these films, it makes it a little hard to watch. And I love that in your book you interview the actor who played Long Duk Dong, Getty Watanabe.
Yeah.
What did he have to say about being seen as this very offensive stereotype by some?
So a couple of things. One, it is I did watch all of these movies and have to take them with a large grain of salt because there is something profoundly sort of oblivious and stupid about them sometimes. I mean, and I would be more willing to call them racist and homophobic because in some ways they obviously are if I thought the people who made them were ill-intentioned. And I think what they were mostly doing was, in the case of 16 Candles, 16 Candles is broad comedy. And for someone of John Hughes's talents, of course he came from National Lampoon, where stupid and offensive was sort of the coin of the realm. But that was John Hughes's first comedic gig. But I just think John Hughes is better than that. I think John Hughes is smarter and a greater nuanced writer and director than we see in 16 Candles. I think his best work was yet to come after that, and I think the places where he really falls flat are in the scenes you just mentioned.
So you don't think Hughes deserves a pass that because it was the times, you know, that kind of portrayal was more acceptable?
No, I think he is clearly a young, inexperienced filmmaker in that movie. And the places where he is obliviously racist and misogynistic in that movie. I don't give them a pass, but I also don't wrap him about the shoulders with a yardstick either. But when I talked to Getty Watanabe, who by the way was 30 when he did that movie and trained with Joseph Papp's Shakespeare Company in New York, I mean, Getty Watanabe was a classically trained actor who has been working pretty much consistently since 16 Candles, has had a very successful career as a character actor. You probably saw him in ER or places like that. Mm-hmm. To him, he was engaged in an act of not only broad comedy, but this kind of comedy where comedy sort of shakes loose its bounds of humanness and becomes a force of nature. I mean, I do not find Long Duk Dong enlightened or smart or sophisticated, but I think the sheer comic verve that he brings to it, I associate the character with John Belushi in Animal House or Jeff Spicoli in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. The character is almost bigger than the movie they occupy. And so they're like a comedic weather system. And I thought that there was a real as a performance, there is a real comedic sophistication to that performance that I give all credit to Getty Watanabe.
Mm. And it's just unfortunate that there were so few Asian actors to sort of vary
Absolutely.
The portrayal
yeah.
so that that type of depiction didn't necessarily stick and get attributed to a particular racial
Yeah,
ethnic
it,
group.
It would have been great if Getty Watanabe could have brought all of his talents to a character that didn't have to rely on these sort of stupid adolescent stereotypes the way that character does. And yet when I spoke to him, he said it was my first movie and I understood this was a broad comedy. And so I played it as broad as possible. And I also was very clear that Long Duk Dong is a character who is a hungry kid sitting at the banquet. He's brand new in this country, and this country has shown its bounty to him, and he's eating it up. I also really appreciated a nuance that he gave to me, where he said, first of all, every character in 16 Candles, minus Molly Ringwald, is a stereotype. There's uptight grandparents. There's obnoxious little brothers. Crude gym teachers. It operates on that level comedically to some degree. And also, he said, the movie is not mean to Long Duk Dong. The movie does not punish Long Duk Dong for being himself, which I think there's something slight to be said for that.
We're talking with Kevin Smokler about his new book, Brat Pack America, a love letter to 80s teen movies, where he celebrates films like 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club, Back to the Future, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Valley Girl, so many others. He interviews cast members and visits some iconic locations where the films took place, including the Chicago suburbs and Santa Cruz, or Santa Carla in The Lost Boys. So Kevin Smokler, how do you have it both ways, meaning recognizing and disliking and feeling like Hughes could have tried harder, but also enjoying those movies?
I think it is possible to enjoy the movies, and I enjoy pretty much every one of them of the 45 that are in this book, and to also say, okay, we were not sort of where we should be as film lovers, as filmmakers, as a country, and as human beings, and I think that's fair. Like the thing I'm after in this book, in Brat Pack America, is that when we watch these movies, we are not looking at relics of a lost civilization. We are in fact looking at a stage in the progress of America that we build to now. We are living in the pop culture ecosystem that these movies created.
Yeah. I like something that Jason Diamond said. He wrote Searching for John Hughes, where he said, you can like something, but pick it apart. Don't love it blindly, kind of thing.
Yeah, there's a rigor with which you bring to it. The same way like your best friendships are complicated and marriages are complicated and serious relationships are complicated. You bring your whole self to it, body, mind, soul. And that's to me, that's really what loving something is about. It's not about obedience.
Well, we asked our listeners to tell us what favorite 80s teen movie they have, the movie they loved. And Susan writes, Valley Girl. It was sweet without having to be vulgar. Andrew says, The Secret of My Success with Michael J. Fox, a very funny script. Now that didn't make it into your book, but was that because he wasn't necessarily a teen at that point?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. These are the weird sort of rule making you have to do when you're putting a book together and you want it to get done in 2 years, is what is an 80s teen movie? What is the 1980s? And what is a teen movie? And Michael J. Fox actually says in Secret of My Success, they say, how old are you, Bradley? And he says, I'm 24, which is a little older than a teen. But a great movie that I enjoy very much. But I had to sort of play neighborhood cop a bunch and decide what exactly qualified for this book and what didn't.
Well, Elizabeth writes, Some Kind of Wonderful. And William says, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, no doubt. Now, that is a movie, I think, is it in the Library of Congress? Because it's
is.
A work of enduring importance to American culture. Talk about the impact of that film.
It certainly is. It is, in fact, there are, in fact, 9 80s teen movies on the Library of Congress's National Film Registry. And the next decade that comes closer in terms of teen movies is the 50s, which has 4. So it is the one of the great cinematic legacies from this time. And just this year, they were announced about 3 weeks ago, The Breakfast Club is now on that list too. As is Decline of Western Civilization and The Princess Bride, which isn't technically an 80s teen movie, but I think it's very much of that era too.
Why did Ferris Bueller's Day Off have such appeal?
Oh, God, that's such a good question. There's so many schools of thought on that. Some people say, well, Ferris Bueller was my hero when I was growing up because Ferris Bueller could get away with anything. Personally, I always related more to Cameron, and I think Cameron is the real main character of that story. The character that changes and goes on an emotional journey is Cameron and not Ferris. And I think there is certainly wish fulfillment to it. Everybody wishes they could ditch school and drive around in a Ferrari for the day. I think that's a fairly common adolescent, probably male fantasy, but whatever. And I also think there is an element of sadness that John Hughes put in that movie, which makes it poignant instead of just escapist. It is the end of school, and Ferris has that scene where he says, we'll have the summer together, and then basically that will be it. Cameron will go his way, I'll go mine, and it'll never be the same again. And you realize that this day off isn't just because Ferris, you know, wants to stick it to the principal or something. The day off is so they can grab these last strands of being friends together before they grow up. And there's an undercurrent of sadness to Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which I think gives it more heft than just being an hour and 40 minutes of driving around in a Ferrari.
What you're saying reminds me a little bit about what you wrote about the character of Jeff Spicoli in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, that he also in some ways represented almost not a dying era per se, as this sort of surfer, stoner. Mm-hmm. He was, but that he wasn't part of that transition to kids, you know, really valuing having money, working to have that money to be able to buy things.
Yeah, if you look at the ensemble cast of Fast Times at Ridgemont High, every kid has a job, and it's fair to say that even Forrest Whitaker's character, his job is playing football, because they make a joke about the fact, does he really go to school? I thought he just flew in for games. The only character who doesn't have a job is Jeff Spicoli, and Jeff Spicoli is at the center of this film as all these hardworking kids kind of swirl around them, and he ends the movie by saying, "All I need is some tasty waves and a cool buzz, and I'm fine." He is a cliche. A Southern California cliche from an earlier era. The Stone Surfer is a cliche of early 1960s Southern California. And here's Jeff Spicoli kind of washed up on the banks of early Reagan era Southern California. And he's kind of there to balance out all the other kids and satirize their ambitions, quite frankly.
Well, let's play a clip of what you just mentioned there about Jeff Spicoli and what's important to him.
You worked at All-American Burger.
7 months ago.
I knew it.
Why don't you get a job, Spicoli?
What for?
You need money.
All I need are some tasty waves, cool buzz, and I'm fine.
He's probably on screen less than any of the other characters in Fast Times, and yet that's the one we remember. Like, that's how great Sean Penn is and how fully realized this character is with not much, like, quite frankly. I love the fact that Spicoli, despite being this sort of force of, you know, polite destruction and irresponsibility, is not mean. Like, Jeff Spicoli is not a bully. He doesn't push anybody else out of the way. Jeff Spicoli is incredibly likable in part because he seems to kind of like everybody.
And for everything that Sean Penn has done since Jeff Spicoli, he's still remembered as Jeff Spicoli.
Two Oscars later, he's still Jeff Spicoli.
Well, this feels like the perfect time to read Doug's comment, which is, "Aloha, Mr. Hand. I am a child of the 80s and love all of these movies, but Fast Times at Ridgemont High is my all-time favorite." We want to hear more of your all-time favorites. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. What 80s teen flick rocked your world? Why do you think teen movies from the 1980s endure? You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org, post them on Facebook, on our website, kqed.org/forum, or you can tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. I'm Mina Kim, and I am in today for Michael Krasny. And actually, we will play a little bit of Oh Yeah, but before we do, I just want to quickly ask you this question from a listener. Is Goonies considered an 80s teen film, or is it categorized as a family film?
Oh, no, it's certainly an 80s teen film. The central relationship in that movie is between six friends who are all versions of or preteens and teenager. Yeah, Goonies gets a lot of love in this book.
Well, we'll talk more about that and more about 80s teen movies. This is Oh Yeah from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. We're talking with Kevin Smokler about his new book, Brat Pack America, a love letter to 80s teen movies, which he describes as a trapper keeper full of interesting facts about your favorite 80s movies, including Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Back to the Future, Some Kind of Wonderful, Say Anything, and Heathers. His book also offers insights into what the films say about America and pop culture from that era and why they're as loved today as they were then. And we've invited our listeners to tell us what their favorite movies of the 1980s are. Let's start with Will in Santa Rosa. Hi, Will.
Hey, how's it going?
Great.
My favorite is Better Off Dead, and I just really liked it because my wife is from Russia, and so I really share a lot of new American culture with her.
Thanks, Will. Unfortunately, I think your line is a little rough, but I did hear you say better off dead, and you have good company here because I think that is among our staff members' favorite 80s movies as well. Let's go next to Linda in Santa Rosa. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I wanted to say anything. I would guess it's one of my favorites because Cusack's portrayal of Lloyd Dobler is just like the most adorable teenage boy ever. I mean, it's so lovable and so real.
Thanks, Linda.
That's my vote.
Yeah, well, thanks for bringing up Say Anything, because I think, you know, before the break, we were talking about Jeff Spicoli, right, mm-hmm. and how he was a throwback, right, to sort of 1960s Southern California surfer culture. And then the 80s were a lot about consumption, right, mm-hmm. and a lot about working to be able to afford to consume. And then you have, at the very end of the 80s, 1989, you have Say Anything, right? And you have Lloyd Dobler, this character who seems to be pushing back against that.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of debate. For each chapter of this book, I created a post on Facebook that said, I'm going to do something about 80s teen movie leading men. Who are your favorites? And then I would sort through them all. And there was a ton of debate in one of those posts. Is Say Anything an 80s teen movie or a 90s teen movie? Mm. Where does this thing called 80s teen movie begin and end? The beginning is a little bit easier. The end is harder. In the end, I've probably seen Say Anything 40 or 50 times. It's one of my favorites. In the end, I had to make a very tough judgment call that the last 80s teen movies is Heathers, which comes out in March of 1989, and Say Anything comes out that summer. Mm. So Say Anything is the bridge between the 80s teen movie and the 90s teen movie. And the idea that it has an ambiguous ending and is about a fractured family and, takes place in Seattle, to me, gives it a bit of an early 90s feel.
Well, let's play this clip from Say Anything. Yeah. This is for you, Linda. let's play this clip from Say Anything, where John Cusack's character, Lloyd Dobler, is trying to answer that dreaded question from your girlfriend's father of what he plans to do with his life.
What are your plans for the future?
Spend as much time possible with Diane before she leaves.
Seriously, Lloyd?
I'm totally and completely serious.
No, really?
You mean like career? I don't know. I've thought about this quite a bit, sir, and I would have to say, considering what's waiting out there for me, I don't want to sell anything, buy anything, or process anything as a career. I don't want to sell anything bought or processed, or buy anything sold or processed, or process anything sold, bought, or processed, or repair anything sold, bought, or processed. You know, as a career, I don't want to do that.
I mean, you can almost hear a little bit of Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life saying, I want to go out. I want to see the world. I want to, in this very sort of uncertain 18-year-old kind of way. Of course, the great Cameron Crowe is where that dialogue comes from. Cameron Crowe, who also wrote Fast Times at Ridgemont High at the beginning of this decade and writes and directs Say Anything at the end.
So if Say Anything is a bridge, how are 80s films different from 90s films? How are those eras represented? Or, you know, is it that the 90s were more, a cynical turn, that they were more critical than, say, the 80s were of where America was going?
I would say the term that I always think of when I think of 80s teen movies, and not all of them, is certainty. That it's pretty clear who are the good guys and the bad guys. It's pretty clear that it's going to end happily. The twists and turns will be interesting. But it's the moral center of those movies is pretty clear. Now that is not always true. There is an undercurrent of 80s teen movie like Over the Edge and Legend of Billie Jean and Running on Empty, which sort of crests with Heathers, which is all in response to the certainty of your Breakfast Clubs and your Pretty in Pinks and your the 90s, that the what was once underground becomes mainstream. Ironically, it happened in music too. And a 90s teen movie is characterized by moral ambiguity, often by families of choice rather than families that we are born into, friendship over family, often the preeminence of work and school place relationships, parents kind of recede into the background, and of course the turn towards a more diverse America begins really with the 90s teen movie. The image of it begins with in a 90s teen movie.
Well, Nick writes, and this is alluding to our earlier conversation about 16 Candles, it's critically important to remember these are white stories about white kids. As a Korean-American growing up in the 80s, 16 Candles was a horrible experience with the aforementioned Long Duk Dong character, to not mention the white normative perspective. And for this guest to gloss over the racism and misogyny in these films is truly unfortunate. We can celebrate these films and also be honest about what's wrong with them in the same way we look back on all American history.
I think Nick is exactly right, and no glossing intended. I think we have to be very clear that these movies were made from a distinct point of view, a heteronormative white up and upper middle class point of view. And to say that that was the typical American experience even back then is just plain wrong. I think what John Hughes did successfully is he was able to make those movies relatable, obviously not to everybody, but to a large group of people beyond who was seen on screen. Because frankly, we wouldn't even be having this conversation about John Hughes if they weren't as successful as they were. And one of the things that was very important to me to do in the section about John Hughes was to interview non-Caucasian John Hughes fans. And I spent a lot of time talking to people who did not grow up that way, did not see themselves in the actors who were on screen, and to say, what was the experience of loving John Hughes but not feeling represented by John Hughes like?
Yeah.
So no glossing intended. I in his book, I fully accept these movies for both their strengths and their very obvious limitations.
We're talking with Kevin Smokler, who wrote Brat Pack America, a love letter to 80s teen movies. His other books include Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. Kevin will be in conversation with 99% Invisible's Roman Mars at Spur in Oakland, 1544 Broadway in downtown Oakland, on Thursday, January 12th at 6 p.m. And I should also mention that on February 1st, Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. at Kepler's Bookstore in Menlo Park. Chris tweets, I loved Weird Science. I VHS'd it off the TV and watched it over and over. You do devote a little bit of time to Weird Science in your book and this whole genre of 80s teen movies that looked at the personal computer industry, which was born in the 1980s and spawned movies like War Games and Weird Science. And it touched on these fears of like what can happen with this machinery in the hands of teens.
Absolutely. You know, that chapter came later than all the rest of them, and I called it We Can't Rewind, We've Gone Too Far, Teens and Technology. People of a certain age will know what that means. But it is very clear. If you talk to anyone in Silicon Valley who grew up in this time or is at least familiar with the pop culture of this time, they will all give credit to both War Games and Real Genius as proto-Silicon Valley movies. We don't get the Silicon Valley TV show. We don't get the movie Hackers. We don't get any of the pop culture associated with technology without the pioneering efforts of War Games and Real Genius. Weird Science is a sillier example of those movies. I think it's great fun, and it's not, frankly, any more politically progressive than 16 Candles is, and John Hughes made it shortly right around that time also. But as a coming of age best friend kind of movie that also includes a pretty prescient look at the early days of personal computers, I love Weird Science.
Well, let's hear from Carl in San Jose. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I was wondering, looking in the other direction toward the 70s, how much did George Lucas's American Graffiti influence the 80s movies, teen movies?
A really good question, Carl. Tons is the answer. American Graffiti is a very different movie than these movies were. American Graffiti comes out in 1973, but is about 1961. So it is a nostalgic movie about a previous era that was really intended for people who were in their 20s and 30s looking back at their own teenage years. But the idea of teenage stories being front and center in a story, the idea about the adolescents slipping away. American Graffiti is pointedly on the last day of summer before everybody goes off in their separate directions. American Graffiti is pioneering for all of those reasons, and really still a fantastic movie. Its intentions were different, but the idea of the teen ensemble cast really begins in the 1970s with American Graffiti, and we can trace a direct line from there to Fast Times at Ridgemont High to Can't Hardly Wait, and to probably in the 2010s, maybe Easy A. maybe Mean Girls.
Mm. Well, Carl, thanks so much for bringing up George Lucas. Jamila writes, I'm an 80s kid and absolutely loved all the movies mentioned. My mom actually used to go with me to watch them because when she was a teen, nothing was made directly for people her age. My question is, how are these movies holding up for a younger generation? I have friends who are millennials who don't connect with these older movies in the way Gen Xers do.
Yeah, I mean, some do and some don't. I have a friend who has teenage kids who showed Back to the Future to them, and they didn't get it because to them, 1985 is the past. And so the narrative of 1985 being the present, 1955 being the past, doesn't make any sense to them. On the other hand, I am astonished by how often I meet parents who are my age and their teenage kids, and they say things like, we watch Goonies and Gremlins and Real Genius and Back to the Future together. And not only do they experience what I experienced as a teenager, but they feel like they are movies for them too. There are breaks in that chain. I find someone who is – most of the people I know who are in their 20s, who grew up with a different era in pop culture, most sort of typical – you know, demographically – millennials in the dead center of that demographic don't often relate to this period in pop culture. But Gen Xers and their kids seem to a whole lot.
Well, let's play a little bit of Back to the Future, just because it was such an influential movie of the 80s, which is kind of amazing. It's staying power if you think about it. This is Back to the Future, the first one, and this is the moment when Doc Brown zaps his dog Einstein away into who knows where.
Where the hell are they?
The appropriate question is, where in the hell are they? You see, Einstein has just become the world's first time traveler.
Wait a minute, Doc. Are you telling me that you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
The way he delivers that is so funny. Back to the Future is interesting because in rewatching it, it idolizes in some ways. It makes the 1950s look sort of purer and cleaner and more lovely, but then at the same time suggests that maybe it's not as well.
Oh, very much so. Ronald Reagan loved Back to the Future. They showed it at the White House for him. And in the line where he says, so tell me, future boy, who's president in 1955? And Michael J. Fox says, Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan fell off the couch laughing, and the projectionist had to stop the movie so the president could pick himself back up and compose himself. I think in part Ronald Reagan loved it because of this frankly false idealization of the 1950s, which Hill Valley 1955 represents, this sort of wasn't America great before the 60s wrecked everything, which is a totally false narrative. And in fact, Back to the Future admits as much.
It's a narrative actually that has strong currents right now.
Absolutely. And Back to the Future, instead of holding it up, undercuts it. It makes Hill Valley 1985 look kind of crappy, and it also makes Doc Brown seem unfairly punished for being who he is. Doc Brown is clearly both the moral and the intellectual center of this movie, and it looks like Hill Valley has cast him aside as a freak and is paying and is the worse for it. The movie is actually, I think the Back to the Future, all three movies are really about how we have to face time and not be foolishly idealistic or nostalgic about it, that time will affect us all. And so I think those movies are actually, I think those movies are misread as idealizing the 50s and are actually about having a mature, level-headed approach to time.
Interesting. Well, let's go to Todd in Alameda. Hi, Todd.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Hi, Todd.
Hi. I'm calling because I was born in 1977, so I grew up with all of these films and loved a bunch of them. But as I got older in my 20s and started having, or I guess even late teens, and having adult relationships, be it emotional or my first physical and emotional adult relationships, I find now, almost 40, that some of these films maybe gave me an unrealistic view of what adult relationships should have been like, or my first adult relationships in my late teens. Well, I thought that, I'm supposed to meet Ione Skye, and I'm supposed to, no matter what, we're supposed to fall in love and fly to London, and everything's cool, even though her dad thinks I'm a loser.
And put ourselves totally on the line.
Right. And I feel like as a 40-year-old, it's like, if my daughter was dating the kickboxer, I'm like, I don't know, honey.
Todd, you are so right. When Pretty in Pink celebrated its 30th birthday last winter, I wrote a piece for Salon that said, "Dear teenage boys," something like, "Dear teenage boys of today, do not look up to Ducky. I made that mistake." Like, yes, a message to all teenage boys out there: do not be Ducky and do not be Lloyd Dobler. Insofar as the serenading of the Otis Redding song and the holding a boombox outside someone's window, outside the girl of your dreams' window. These are movies. They do operate on a level of fantasy and myth and imagination, and it is hard not to use them as guides. I just think, as Todd has pointed out, that is one of the gifts of maturity is that we no longer use them as guides and we can enjoy them in some other way.
But the point is, you're representing teenagers and the way they feel in that moment, right? Or yeah. And let's hear from Neil in San Francisco. Hi, Neil.
Yeah, you just mentioned Pretty in Pink. I was a little surprised you haven't mentioned it before. Now, there's one more point I'd like to make. Doesn't it bother anybody that Ferris Bueller's Day Off was Dan Quayle's favorite movie?
Well, shoot, I didn't know that. Now that bothers me. on your earlier point, yes, Pretty in Pink has a real place of honor in this book, along with Some Kind of Wonderful, which are two movies that are often seen as two halves of a whole, and I think stand very well on their own, each one of them.
You mean because of the way they address class issues too?
They both address class. They're both very much about the Los Angeles of the 1980s in a way that John Hughes, who's movies were resolutely Chicago, do not. They were not directed by John Hughes. They were written by John Hughes. And they address male-female friendships in a way that John Hughes sort of did not wade into in most of his movies. I mean, to some extent, but I think the kiss in Some Kind of Wonderful, which is the kiss between Eric Stoltz and Mary Stuart Masterson, which is one friend teaching another friend how to kiss when one friend is actually in love with the other friend, and it happens in an Autobahn. I mean, one of the great kisses in movie history, because it does blur that line between friendship and romance, which is especially poignant for teenagers, but even exists in adult lives, too.
We're talking with Kevin Smokler, author of Brat Pack America, A Love Letter to 80s Teen Movies. And Kevin Smokler, can you talk about that title? Who is the Brat Pack? What was the Brat Pack?
So the Brat Pack was named by a 1985 New York Magazine article profiling Judd Nelson, Andrew McCarthy, and Emilio Estevez on the set of St. Elmo's Fire. St. Elmo's Fire is not in my book, Brat Pack America, because it is a movie about the years immediately after college and not about being a teenager. But it basically was the term Brat Pack was speculating that there is a new class of young actors coming of age, both chronologically and professionally, in the 1980s, who are the Hollywood stars of today. It was a mess from the start in terms of terminology. The actors were often 10 years apart in age. Judd Nelson is a decade older than Molly Ringwald. Some of them didn't even know each other. Some of them never appeared on screen together. So it was a sloppy term. I use it basically as shorthand, because when you say Brat Pack, you are talking about an 80s teen movie.
Well, Katie writes, "I loved anything with John Cusack. He is still so funny to me. He was never part of the Brat Pack. A little more offbeat and funny. Better Off Dead, The Sure Thing, Say Anything, and on and on. And I loved The Outsiders. Matt Dillon was such a heartthrob. Little darlings, OMG. 3 exclamation points.
These are all such great movies. I had the rare privilege of doing a book event in Tulsa this fall, where when I was picked up at the airport, they said, "Do you want to go see The Outsiders house?" And I was like, "Would I?" And so they took me to the neighborhood where The Outsiders house was. It is currently being restored to be unveiled for the 50th anniversary of The Outsiders book, which is this April. And it'll be an Outsiders museum. And most of the locations for The Outsiders were all filmed within a couple of blocks of each other in North Tulsa. Yeah, that's such a great movie. And John Cusack, I mean, Better Off Dead and One Crazy Summer. I got to talk to the writer-director of those movies, Savage Steve Holland, for this book. And the comedic sensibility of those movies is so weird and wacky and ridiculous and ahead of its time. I did some research. It is amazing the number of comedy writers and stand-up comedians who cite Better Off Dead and One Crazy Summer as formative in their own comic sensibilities.
Well, Jeffrey writes, Fast Times at Ridgemont High must have been rated R. It was pretty strong, sexual dialogue and fantasies, et cetera, which in some ways was, I think, the point, right? Fast Time, that things moved very quickly, maybe faster than the teens could quite really understand it. He goes on to say, though realistic for teens of the time, parents were probably appalled. Interesting that teens would have had to break the rules to watch it. Stace writes, how about the 80s anti-teen movie Suburbia with a young flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers?
Sure.
You do mention this. Yeah.
Oh, yes. There's a whole chapter in this. There's a whole chapter in what I call the sort of college radio 80s teen movie, the alternative to the pop music of the John Hughes movies. Suburbia is in that chapter, as is Over the Edge and The River's Edge, filmed right here in the Bay Area. And that movie, those movies kind of come to their apogee with Heathers, which is the anti-teen movie, sort of blowing up the whole genre. That the end of the 80s teen movies is Heather's satirization of the 80s teen movie.
Isaac asks, is Dazed and Confused considered a teen movie?
It's definitely considered a teen movie. Dazed and Confused, structure-wise, is American Graffiti set in the 1970s, except it's about the last day of school instead of the last day of summer. And it came out in 1993 and I think is the rightful heir to American Graffiti and then Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Aaliyah in Oakland. Hi, Aaliyah.
Hi. I have a couple of points that I wanted to – first of all, this is really funny. I had a laugh because I was just watching Better Off Dead and Adventures in Babysitting last night with my boyfriend who has never seen them before, even though he was a teenager during that time. So this was really kind of serendipitous. But something that you guys were talking about during this whole your talk right now is, just mentioning that like how these movies were primarily white films. And I thought it was just, and it just never struck me before. And I just wanted to say that in the 70s and the 80s, and actually earlier than that, most movies were just white. And if there were movies with black people in them, they were movies that were just black. So for me as a black teenager, I didn't feel like there was anything out of the norm because that was just what was happening mm-hmm. there during that time. I have to say that I do love integrated work, and I do love representation that shows that white, black, or any other type of people can interact with each other normally in human life. But at the time, that's just the way it was. And I just love the movies.
Well, Aaliyah, thanks for sharing that. I really appreciate it. Curious what, Kevin Smoker, your take is on Adventures in Babysitting.
I don't care for Adventures in Babysitting. I think I liked it, in 1987 because I had a crush on Elizabeth Shue from The Karate Kid. You watch it. Adventures in Babysitting is a racist pile of junk, if you ask me. And it's really funny to watch Adventures in Babysitting now because the entire premise is that like good white kids live in the suburbs and dangerous people of color live in the city. And you flash forward to a movie like Perks of Being a Wallflower, which came out in 2013, and ends with three kids triumphantly driving into downtown Pittsburgh, as if to say, "Hello, youth of America, your future will be in America's great cities," where that movie in the days of Adventures in Babysitting would have been them fleeing to the suburbs as quickly as they could. It's a total different view of American cities in teen movies. Now, Adventures in Babysitting does not do much for me. And to Aaliyah's point, it was very important to me that this book capture the full range of what it meant to be young in America at this time. So there's an entire chapter on the first generation of hip-hop movies, which begins with Wild Style and kind of reaches its crest in 1989 with House Party. Which is really in terms of pure pleasure, probably my favorite 80s teen movie.
And where is the role? What is the role of place now? Where is an interesting way that I phrased that initially. I guess that's on my mind because you make the point that it doesn't feel as salient anymore in some ways.
Yeah, you're right. It doesn't feel as salient or as necessary. Juno, which comes out in 2007, is clearly a more interesting movie because it's filmed in Minneapolis, but then filmed in sort of a nameless San Fernando Valley suburb. But it's not crucial to the story Juno is telling. I think place has receded a little bit, significantly, I should say, in terms of the teen movie experience. But it also, when it is significant, it is also twice as significant because it happens less often. It's no coincidence that people go to Forks, Washington to see if they can see the places in Twilight, even though I would say Twilight doesn't need to happen in Forks, Washington.
Well, before we go out, who do you see as the current great teen movie makers right now?
Oh, that's a hard question. It's hard to link it to a particular director or filmmaker, which is not to say there aren't great teen movies now. Dope, Mean Girl and the Dying Girl, Edge of 17. Like, there's lots of great teen movies being made now. I am eager to say, who is the next great teen filmmaker? If I were to write Brat Pack America today, who would I talk to? I don't know, but I'm eager to find out.
Well, Kevin Smokler, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Mina. This is great.
Kevin Smokler's book is Brat Pack America, a love letter to 80s teen movies. You can catch him in conversation with 99% Invisible's Roman Mars at Spur Oakland on Thursday, January 12th at 6, and on Wednesday, February 1st at 7:30 at Kepler's Bookstore in Menlo Park. We're going to go out with Otis Redding's Try a Little Tenderness for all you Ducky fans out there, for all those of you who related to Ducky Dale in Pretty in Pink. But before we do, let me tell you that Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And Holly Curtin is our executive producer. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.